Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The California law prohibiting unfair business practices is the basis for the litigation brought in the name of the people of the state of California against the Pacific Lumber Company, based in Eureka, Humboldt County, California. The facts of the case are found in the documents that the Pacific Lumber Company provided to the California Department of Forestry at the time of the agreement on saving one of the last untouched areas of old-growth redwoods in California, known as the Headwaters. Attorney Tim Stone is the assistant district attorney in Humboldt County and the lead attorney representing the people of the state of California in this case. I first met Tim Stone when he was the assistant district attorney here in Mendocino County in 1974. The Humboldt County case he has filed has the potential for being extremely significant in several areas of the law. I spoke with attorney Tim Stone from his home in Eureka, California on Saturday morning, September 20th, 2003, and asked him to begin our conversation by talking about the goals and the long-term intentions of this litigation.
Well, the lawsuit was filed under the unfair competition law of the state of California and alleges fraud by Pacific Lumber Company regarding the Headwaters Forest Project. The case really is quite simple on its fundamental facts. We allege that in November of 1998, Pacific Lumber fed false information to the government on a watershed, claiming that only 15% of the landslides were due to recent logging in the Jordan Creek watershed. And then we claim that they discovered their error, if it wasn't intentional, in January of 1999, and they concealed it. And the error was significant because the corrected data was that 60% of the landslides had occurred during recent timber harvesting, and that 77% of the sediment that was delivered into the streams occurred from recent timber harvesting. So you had a diametrically opposite conclusion.
You say they discovered the error if it was not intentional. What do you mean? Do you think that they were hiding something from you?
What happened is they claim that they don't dispute that the initial information was false. They claim it was a mistake. I haven't concluded discovery in the case yet to look at the emails between Pacific Lumber and their consultant to determine whether or not it was intentional or not. So I'm trying to be fair to Pacific Lumber in saying that I don't have positive proof yet that it was intentional. But the issue is not the false information, the motivation behind it. The issue is the concealment, which I claim was intentional. And the reason why it's important is that the initial information that was false was given to the government for the purpose of inclusion into the final environmental impact report on Headwaters. And then the false data was actually included in the final environmental impact report on Headwaters. And after that it was published, the final environmental impact report, you had a window of about 30 days before it was going to be certified. Well, at the very beginning of that window, Pacific Lumber submitted the corrected report. And what they were required to do under both general principles of law and under the setup for the Headwaters Forest Project was to give the corrected information to the same person that was in a position to correct it, and that was the director of CDF. So what they did instead is they fed the corrected information to the Fortuna office of CDF and the Santa Rosa office of CDF, but they did not transmit it to the director of CDF. Therefore, the director of CDF never got it. if he had gotten it, then he would have had to stop the whole project in its tracks, and he would have had to recirculate the final EIR not only to the officials in government, but to the public, and the public could have weighed in. So the public was basically defrauded from an opportunity to weigh in on the environmental costs of the Headwaters Forest Project. And the environmental impact report is the fundamental document before, and it's the understructure on which the superstructure of the sustained yield plan and the habitat conservation plan relied.
So what is their response to all of this?
The response to this is one, we admit we made a mistake, but it was only a mistake. It wasn't intentional. Secondly, we did give it to the government. It's not our fault that it didn't make its way to the director of CDF. And my response to that is, well, you are a sophisticated company, and you knew that the outlying agencies for CDF had no way of knowing the significance of the data. If you had said in your cover letter to Fortuna and Santa Rosa, oh, by the way, this is contradictory information from previous information, or secondly, you would have said that this is significant new information, or thirdly, you would have said, please transmit this on high to the director of CDF, I would have had no problem. But you didn't do any of those three things.
And you're claiming they knew or should have known that that was required.
That's correct. Now, this has a lot of significance because in our world that's increasingly bureaucratic and complex, if you can provide false information to a decision maker in an agency and then come back with corrected information and you give it to a subordinate below that decision maker with no instructions to make it up to the top where the decision maker is, then what you're doing is you're just playing a trick on the body politic and on the public. So there's a lot, I call it concealment by bureaucracy.
And what is their response at this point?
Well, their response, so that's their second response, was, well, we did comply by sending it to Fortuna. And I'm saying what I said just to you. And then thirdly, with respect to the merits, they're saying that my lawsuit was filed too late because there's a 4-year statute of limitations, and you have to start compiling the date from the date that the false information was provided, which would mean that since I filed it in February of 2003, that we were beyond the 4-year statute of limitations. My response to that is no. The issue is not when the original bad act took place. It's when the substantial damage occurred. And that didn't occur until you withheld this data from the director of CDF. See, if the director of CDF had gotten the data when PL acknowledged the corrected data, the director of CDF would have had 30 days to ruminate about the data and then make his decision that it was significant new information and then recirculate the EIRs. So they withheld it. Now, the basic defense is, in addition to the statute of limitations, is that under the First Amendment, a business dealing with the government has a right to lie. Now, I know that sounds pretty bold, but they're basically saying under the antitrust laws that have developed, the courts have allowed a certain robust exchange in political contexts, and therefore, and the courts don't want to get into that thicket, and therefore they know that there will be false things said, intentional or not, and that there's always a counteracting occasion either in the court system or in a political system. And I'm arguing that may be true before a city council or before a state legislature. And it may be true in a lawsuit, but it's not. It should not be extended to an administrative agency proceeding where you don't have any cross-examination, you don't have any subpoena power, you don't have any referee to contest the falsity. And so this is kind of a new era, because they're trying to extend that antitrust doctrine of a right to lie to an administrative agency setting, which I contend requires you to be truthful in all of your submissions.
The phrase, the right to lie, is that your characterization of they're saying? Those are their words?
They basically say this. They say the right to lie is their words, predicated this way. They say, we're saying that the information we originally provided was false, but even if it had been a lie, we would have had a right to lie under the First Amendment. So it's their words, but it's in that conditional context. So I characterize this case as the rule of law versus the right to lie. That's why this case, in my opinion, is highly significant, because it has all kinds of implications for a democratic society.
So where is the case in the courts right now?
The case in the courts right now is that it's under submission before a judge who has heard arguments on a demurrer. A demurrer is basically a document that says, so what? In other words, PL has taken my complaint and said, so what? It's too late just on its terms, therefore it should be thrown out under the statute of limitations. It goes against this antitrust doctrine of a right to lie even, and therefore it should be thrown out on those grounds. And then there's a third ground involving a California law giving a what's called a litigation privilege that's pretty much similar to this right to lie under the antitrust laws.
When do you expect a ruling?
Well, the judge under the law has 90 days from the hearing, and that was argued on July 28th, which means he probably has till October 24th or October 25th. And because there are probably over 100 cases cited between all the briefs, and the judge is a conscientious judge, he's going to be reading those cases, and a lot of these are Supreme Court cases, that it's a big job, and he's got a full-time judicial practice that he has to carry on as well. So I don't expect that we'll get a ruling until the middle of October. At this point now, we're in the discovery phase, and one of the problems I have is the Board of Supervisors in Humboldt County is hostile to my lawsuit, and they turned down my request to bring in Joe Cotchett on a contingency of 14.5% of whatever it is that we would collect, because they didn't want to give institutional approval to the filing of the lawsuit.
Who's Joe Cotchett?
Joe Cotchett is one of the really top-tier trial lawyers in the United States. He got the $1.3 billion verdict against Charles Keating of Lincoln Savings and Loan. So he's first rate, and he believed in the case that much that he was willing to take it on a contingency. I had to go to the Board of Supervisors because the money that we collect in this case is money that goes to the treasurer of the county where the judgment is rendered, which means it goes into the general fund of our county. Now, you asked me about the aims of the lawsuit. The aims of the lawsuit are basically to get the judge to impose a civil penalty on PL based on its fraud, and then I'm asking for the judge to reduce the cut that's been authorized each year from 176 million board feet to 136 million board feet on the basis that PL is gaining additional earnings of $40 million per year based on this fraud.
I'd like to take a moment and say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Tim Stone, the assistant district attorney in Humboldt County in Northern California, about an unfair business practices lawsuit that he's filed in the name of the people of the state of California against the Pacific Lumber Company, one of the larger employers in Humboldt County. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Tim, this lawsuit has been a significant impetus for a recall of your boss, Paul Gallegos, the elected district attorney of Humboldt County. What's going on with that, and how is the recall connected with your litigation?
Well, it's connected to the litigation directly because this lawsuit created a frenzy. And by the way, Paul Gallegos knew it would, but he has so much integrity and he has so much courage that after he read the lawsuit, just before I was going to file it, he said to me, Tim, I could not live with myself if I didn't file it. And I told him, I said, Paul, you're going to get it. I mean, this is going to be a frenzy. And I said, it's not only on the merits of the lawsuit, they're going to bring up everything about my past, you know, having been the lawyer at one time for Jim Jones. And said, you got to expect that. And he still went ahead and did it. Now, PL's not fooled. PL is very smart. They have very sophisticated people working for them. And they know that Paul is basically doing really a good job, and they started claiming that he was soft on crime, and that's gone away because we have the same attorneys in the office that we had under the previous administration. Our conviction rate is no less than it was before, and the number of filings has probably gone up 23%. So Paul is doing an excellent job. So that's kind of dissipated. Now it's basically the recall is based on the PL lawsuit. And PL itself, and not just the press, but PL itself has raised the issue about my background. And so it's going to be a nasty ride if it gets qualified. I think it will be qualified. They have until October 22nd to get in all the signatures. They claim that they have between 12 and 15,000. And so I think that it will go, and that then I'll have to be in campaign mode for Paul, and Paul will have to be in campaign mode as well until March when the election takes place.
Talk about the signatures and the numbers that they have.
Okay.
You're relying on their information.
Right.
And you have a lot of political savvy and political background from your own experience as a activist and a candidate. Do you see people on the street corners soliciting signatures?
Yes. In fact, I was solicited myself in front of the post office about a month ago. It was kind of tricky the way it was done. If somebody had a set of petitions there, and this lady asked me, would you like to sign a signature? It's about, and I went to the post office, and I came back, well, tell me what they're about. And she said, well, this is about getting the legislature's salaries to be blocked if they don't pass a budget. And I said, well, what about the second one? She said, that's for the recall against Gallegos. And I said, oh, Gallegos is a fantastic district attorney, and just walked away. So I know they're out there. And then the reason why I think that, there's some statements in the press recently that the recall effort is floundering, but I don't believe that that's going to be the status at the end of the next 4 weeks. Somebody's out there right now scurrying around to get these endorsements from groups in favor of the recall, so I anticipate that PL will not sit back. It's cost-effective for PL to have Paul recalled, because then the new DA gets rid of me, and then the lawsuit goes away. There's nobody else in the office that's going to be able to do it. So why wouldn't they do that?
What's the position of the state attorney general on this case? Will they step in on for one side or the other?
Well, we've asked them to, and we're disappointed that Lockyer didn't choose to do it.
Did Lockyer explain why?
Yeah, well, his explanation is that he's representing the state agencies in a different case involving Headwaters, which was filed by Epic. And our position is that case is totally different. That's against the state agencies. We're not naming the state agencies as any defendant. We're claiming that the state agencies were victims, and therefore he could come in and help defend us if he wanted. But PL was very sophisticated way back in 1996 when they entered into the original agreements with Dianne Feinstein and the U.S. government and the California government. They put a provision in the contract that said that if a third party sues to undo the Headwaters Forest Project, that the agencies will come to the defense of PL, or words to that. You know, that's the basic import.
But maybe not. There may not be a third party, because you represent the people of the state of California who entered into the agreement. So in some sense, you're representing one of the parties to the agreement.
That's not the position that the AG's office has taken. And I can't speak for them. I mean, I happen to think Lockyer's a pretty good guy, and I don't really like to knock him on the radio, but I think he could have. I think he could have come in. The other reason that he may be claiming not to do it is that in the course of the Epic lawsuit, he may have had to work with the attorneys for PL, and in that course of working with them, maybe communications had been of a confidential nature had been communicated to him. But I don't know what he's going to say, but that's all I know. I can't speak for him because I'm not him.
You talked about being in the campaign mode beginning from when the signatures are certified, which would
that's
be
correct.
Approximately a month after they're submitted.
Right.
Up until the March 2nd election. What would that mean for you, this lawsuit, and Paul Gallegos?
Well, what it means for me is that I have to go out and talk to all the people that are inclined to vote for the recall, because they're getting, you know, the information is being spun. And so I would go to, you know, I I stated to the press that I am prepared to go to every single timber group in the county and every church and talk about the suit, talk about my background, talk about whatever it is that may be on their mind. And I owe that to Paul, because Paul is an extraordinarily fine human being. And, you know, he asked me to do this job, and it's part of my job to defend him, and I'm happy to do it. But, you know, I like to spend time with my wife and come home at night, so it's not something that I really choose to want to do.
Is that the kind of thing that you could do after office hours only?
Yeah, you're not allowed to. And I suppose one could make an argument that this is pretty closely related to the job itself, if they're trying to get rid of you for something you did on the job. But I have a lot of work in that job because I'm head of the white-collar crime unit, and I have four rather significant cases going there, including the PL case. So I have a lot on my plate, and even if I had a right legally to go out and talk about the recall during office hours, my plans are to do it after hours on weekends and during the evenings.
You talk about your background. I know that you were the lawyer for the People's Temple probably about 25 years ago here in Mendocino County. How is that going to affect this situation?
Well, what happened is way back in May, when there was this TV program on California Connected, after the program, there was a website where people could ask questions of Paul Gallegos and of Jim Branham, who's the spokesman for PL. And I was with Paul and was watching these questions being put on the Internet and then the responses from PL. And at one point, Jim Branham says, oh, by the way, do you know that that Tim Stone, the person that filed the suit, was the lawyer for the cult leader Jim Jones? So PL brought it up. It wasn't the press. And so I know that they're playing hardball here. Now I have to go ahead and deal with that.
What's your response?
Well, yeah, I said, of course I was the lawyer for Jim Jones. I mean, that's very common knowledge. I said, but there's two sides to the story here. In addition to my being his lawyer, I said, I'm also the guy that he blamed for his downfall. I turned on him, and I fought him ferociously for a year. And I said, I've always owned up to that, and I made a huge mistake in being joining the temple and defending Jones and not seeing him for what he was. And I said, but I paid a price, you know. And then I've tried to just get my life back on track and be the best I can do and act on the merits of things. And so I'll just have to leave it up to the voters, you know. If they want to hold my mistakes against me, that's fine. That's their right. So I'm at peace about that. I happen to be a Christian, and I believe that I've been forgiven by God, and that my son who died is with the Lord. And so I'm at peace personally about this, but I don't like, it's hard for me to have to go in and discuss this because it hurts other people. It hurts my first wife, who I still love, Grace, and my second wife, who I deeply love, and my boss. So I have three people, you know, that get kind of entangled in something that they had nothing really, that they're not responsible for. So that's part of the game, and I try to grin and bear it.
Tim, you've been involved in many public and controversial issues. We've just discussed two of them. What's in store for you in the next 3 to 5 years? Where do you see yourself going?
Well, I don't know, Barry, because there's something in my intuition tells me that there's more to this case than just this case.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, I was down at the Republican convention this last week, and there's a guy there who has a newsletter that goes out to, he said that probably next month it will be going out to over 1 million people, activists, Republican activists, and that somebody up in Humboldt County has been feeding him information about this case that is taking away a lot of jobs. And when he saw me and my badge, he said, oh, you're the assistant DA of Humboldt County. I said, yeah. And he said, well, why are you taking all these jobs? And I said, well, it's not a jobs issue. It's a fraud issue. And I said, those of us who believe in market economics and free enterprise have a real stake to protect the purity of the system here so that it retains its credibility. And then he said, well, a friend of mine from Pennsylvania called and said that Tim Stone's really a good guy. So he was conflicted. My point is, people see some implications to this case beyond just Humboldt County.
And those are?
Well, it has to do with the rule of law versus the right to lie. That's what I see this case as significance is.
Well, Tim Stone, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us or recommend an interesting book that you've run across lately?
Yeah, a great book that I've read for the second time is John Adams and the American Revolution by Catherine Drinker Bowen. This is not the one by David McCullough. This was written in the 1950s. And it just sort of captures the, you know, here how, you know, this sort of straight-shooting Puritan named John Adams, you know, became a revolutionary, and his cousin Sam Adams, you know, his effectiveness as an agitator, and how the relationship that the two had. And the second one I just read is called The Lion and the Throne, also by Catherine Drinker Bowen, which is on the life of Sir Edward Coke, spelled C-O-K-E, who was the Attorney General for Queen Elizabeth I, and also the architect of the Petition for Right, which was a 17th-century fundamental document of liberties for the Anglo-American jurisprudence. You'd like it because it gets you right into this guy who was really a very aggressive Attorney General, taking on Sir Walter Raleigh and the Earl of Essex, and then how he kind of gets softer over time, but he still has iron in his soul, and then he sort of masterminds against Charles the First this parliamentary effort to preserve the rights of Englishmen. That was great.
Tim Stone, thanks for joining us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure, Barry. Thank you.
Tim Stone is the Assistant District Attorney for Humboldt County, California, and the lead attorney in the case of The People of the State of California versus Pacific Lumber Company. The books he recommends are John Adams and the American Revolution and The Lion and the Throne by Catherine Drinker Bowen. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.